as she said, Bruce Thomas for the appellants Greg Hills and his daughter Ciara Hills. And with me at trial at council table is trial counsel Dean Malone. The summary judgment order dismissing the plaintiff's claims in this case should be reversed for at least three reasons. First, the defendant never met his summary judgment burden because the motion was deficient from the get-go in failing to address our live pleading, and therefore, not surprisingly, the summary judgment evidence was inadequate to address our pleading. Secondly, plaintiff's summary judgment evidence did in fact create a number of fact issues. And third, the defendant's motion failed to address all of our claims, specifically the subsection 4 claim under section 87.004 for the willful and wanton disregard for the safety of Ciara Hills. But even if the appellee could clear those three hurdles, he'd still stand one more additional hurdle as to whether Chapter 87 would be unconstitutional under the facts of this case for closing the doors of the court to the plaintiffs on their common law claims. But as you know, as well as I do, the Court of Appeals doesn't address constitutional issues unnecessarily. And I think the court will decide that it doesn't need to reach the constitutional issues, that the plain old summary judgment principles are more than sufficient to require reversal here. So let me address some of those. The defendant's summary judgment motion just fails to meet its burden. The first thing a defendant has to do to try to prove up summary judgment is to make a prima facie case that the plaintiff cannot recover under its cause of action as pleaded in its petition. That's what the case law says, as pleaded in its petition. The defendant never even attempted to do that because they focused on the wrong petition. They didn't focus on our live pleadings. So quite apart from the subsection 4 issue, they don't address a number of key allegations in our second amended petition that specifically attack whether Mr. Rydell made a reasonable and prudent effort to determine Ciara's ability to safely ride this horse under those circumstances outside the pen. We allege in our petition that Ciara's father specifically told Mr. Rydell not to allow her to ride outside the pen. We allege that the horse was unsuitable for Ciara because it was rarely ridden only by Mr. Rydell when it was ridden, and still young, needed training, that he failed to provide any instruction or warnings to Ciara about how to ride this horse. He failed to try to make it reasonably safe after not following her father's instructions by failing to pony the horse, and he did not appropriately supervise her. None of those allegations are addressed in the plaintiff's summary judgment evidence. They rely upon Mr. Rydell's short affidavit and excerpts from Ciara's deposition, but they just don't address those allegations. I know they want to borrow from our summary judgment evidence to try to shore up their own summary judgment evidence, but they can't do that. Their burden of proof on their motion has to rest firmly on their evidence. The court doesn't turn to our evidence until they meet their prima facie case of showing entitlement to summary judgment on our cause of action as pleaded. And because they didn't do that, that's fatal to the summary judgment order. But we did respond, and we did create a number of fact issues. There are gaping inconsistencies between Ciara's version of events and Mr. Rydell's version of events, where he now claims that he undertook this extensive investigation of her riding skills and put her through a series of drills and paces. Ciara's version of events is that he actually paid very little attention to her, both when she was in the pen and when she was in the field. Ciara's version of events, let me make this clear because my citation was a little convoluted in my brief. Her version of events is in her deposition at pages 22 through 26 and 60 through 64. Pages 22 through 26 and 60 through 64 of her deposition that's attached as Exhibit E to the plaintiff's response. So for example, at page 22, she says that after Mr. Rydell warmed up the horse, he simply turned it over to her and said, do whatever you're comfortable with at this point. And at page 63, she says after Mr. Rydell turned the horse over to her, he went inside the house. He didn't stay out there and perform drills with her. He went inside the house. And when he came back outside the house, he didn't come back to the pen. He went over it and saddled up the other horse, preparing to ride out to the pasture. And there are numerous additional fact issues. Let me concentrate on a couple of more. In their brief, the appellee has focused a lot on the timeline, trying to make the argument that because Ciara was riding the horse for at least a half an hour in the field, that she had the skill to ride the horse. But that entire timeline is also a disputed issue of fact. Ciara testified, at pages 27 and 61, that she had been riding in the pasture only 10 to 15 minutes before the accident. So to the extent Mr. Rydell's theory of defense relies upon expanding the timeline to over an hour and a half, including more than a half hour in the pasture, all of that are disputed issues of facts that the appellee fails to acknowledge. In fact, under Sierra's timeline between when she first gets on the horse in the pen and when she has the accident is as little as 40 minutes and no more than an hour. Nothing like the hour and a half that appellee's arguing in the brief. Additionally, Mr. Hill's testimony specifically refutes Mr. Rydell's testimony as to what he claims he was told. Mr. Rydell's playing some word games in his carefully written affidavit. For example, he claims that he was told that Ciara attended a horseback riding camp. Mr. Hills actually said that Ciara had attended a summer camp where she had done a little bit of horseback riding, and that had been at least a year. So Mr. Hills wasn't bragging upon his daughter's experience. He was attempting to explain why she didn't have the experience to go out in that pasture. Again, Mr. Rydell claims that in his affidavit that he was told that Ciara had taken horseback riding lessons for years. In fact, Mr. Hills actually said that it had been years since Ciara had taken horseback riding lessons. Now, what Mr. Rydell then goes on to claim that he personally observed and thought, I would say it's just the self-serving testimony of an interested witness that cannot support summary judgment and which the jury can choose to disbelieve. I think in this particular instance, it has every reason to end up questioning the credibility of Mr. Rydell if the jury believes the credibility of my client, Mr. Hills. If the jury believes Mr. Hills, that Mr. Rydell had agreed that it was a smart move to confine this riding to the pen, then it can also conclude that his story just doesn't make any sense. Nobody would do what he claims that he did, to immediately launch upon his own self-assessment and investigation to determine if she had the skill to do something he'd already agreed she wouldn't do. She, of course, could end up on the other foot. The jury could disbelieve my client, question his credibility, but that's, of course, exactly why we have trials. There's a major factual dispute between the parties as to the version of events. And the jury could determine those credibility issues for either side. Now, to summarize, when you look at just the plaintiff's evidence, if the burden ever shifted to us to prove a fact issue, Mr. Rydell's investigation basically consists of just three things. One, a conversation with Ciara's father in which he explains to her that she doesn't have the skill to ride outside the pen. Two, Ciara, after her father's out of earshot, saying, I'm really a better than average rider. And three, a general question by Mr. Rydell saying, what type of riding do you do? And she answers, Western and English. That's it. The jury could conclude that every bit of the additional testimony that he gives in his deposition and puts in his affidavit is an embellishment to create a litigation defense. Now the defendant wants to cherry pick additional evidence from our summary judgment response. But as I said, that does nothing to shore up their burden of proof. All it can do is create additional fact issues. Also, in their brief, they spent a lot of time focusing on causation. Well, causation was never put at issue in defendant's summary judgment motion. So I think all of that is beside the point. In fact, the reason we objected to their no evidence motion to begin with And the court did not consider their no evidence motion is because they didn't tell us what elements were at issue. We didn't want to be standing in the Court of Appeals for the first time having read an appellee's brief that causation is at issue, which is what we're doing. And I think to the extent you consider it, it's a very superficial analysis of causation in appellee's brief. They assume without any authority that proximate cause rather than cause in fact is the standard. I think we meet either one. So more importantly, they make an underlying inaccurate assumption that you can only have one proximate cause of an event. Thus, throughout their brief, they talk about the proximate cause and make the argument that if the proximate cause was the unpredictability of a horse, then we can't possibly prove causation. That assumes incorrectly that you cannot have more than one proximate cause. You can have more than one proximate cause. You could have more than one cause in fact. And I don't think it's really subject to reasonable argument that Mr. Rydell's decision to disregard Mr. Hill's desires and advance this ride to the pasture was a substantial factor in bringing about the harm to Ciara. I think there's summary judgment evidence shows substantial issues of fact. Now let me turn to the McConnell era, or what we call the McConnell era, or shorthand, failure to plead 87, a failure to attack section 87.0044. The defendant's arguments that subsection 4 is redundant. Right, if you do a reasonable investigation under subsection 2, then you cannot possibly be liable for willful and wanton conduct under subsection 4. I don't think that's a fair reading of the statute. I don't think it's can be, you can assume that the legislature put a redundant claim for liability in the six items that they list under section 87.004. Subsection 2 requires a reasonable effort to determine the participant's riding ability. You can make all the effort in the world to obtain information about that, and if you don't act on that information and you ignore that information, you can still be held liable under subsection 4 for willful and wanton disregard of the participant's safety. Suppose, for example, an equine professional determined that a young, not well-trained horse was not suitable for a 13-year-old to ride. But then when he goes to the stable, he sees, well, that's all that happens to be here right now, so I'm going to put him on that horse and hope for the best. Well, in that instance, you would have willful and wanton disregard for the safety of the participant and liability under subsection 4 if the participant is then injured. We have a classic gross negligence fact pattern. We have the situation where the defendant refused to personally assume the same risk that he inflicted upon the plaintiff. This was the fact pattern in Lee Lewis Construction versus Harrison that the panel's probably familiar with. We cite Turner versus Franklin, the Dallas case that reversed summary judgment on gross negligence, and it cites Lee Lewis Construction, 70 Southwest 3rd, 778. That's the famous case where the contractor had his own employees use a lifeline, but he didn't require subcontractor employees that he was also responsible for under the facts of that case. Didn't require them to use a lifeline, and one of the subcontractor employees fell to their death. The Supreme Court, in a unanimous opinion, said that that was sufficient evidence for gross negligence, that it was the disparity in the defendant's conduct between the way he treated his own employees and the way he treated subcontractor employees that showed the subjective element of gross negligence. And that's what we have here. We have Mr. Rydell not willing to subject his own children to riding that horse out in the field outside the pen. He wouldn't let Stephen do it, who happens to be 2 years older than Ciara. You can see in his deposition. But he nevertheless allowed Ciara to take that risk. So subsection 4, subsection 2, they address different conduct. So it's not harmless error when the defendant's summary judgment motion doesn't address the section 4 liability, subsection 4 liability. Summary, they didn't address the facts in our live pleading. They didn't address all of our claims. We have plenty of fact issues from our summary judgment evidence, and the summary judgment should be reversed. Answer any questions?
I like to know why you made no mention so far of your claim of unconstitutionality. It wasn't briefed by...
I think I'm ahead on that point because they didn't brief it. I did mention that they would have that hurdle, and because I don't think you're going to reach it, and I think I need to spend my limited time on those other issues. That doesn't mean I don't think it's a good constitutional issue. I do very much think it's a good constitutional issue. I don't see any reasonable connection between cutting off the plaintiff's right to sue on these common law claims and the purpose of the statute to promote equine tourism. I think it's... Yes. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Greg Ave. I'm here on behalf of the appellees in this matter, defending the summary judgment granted by the district court in this instance based upon the equine liability limitation statute. I think the first thing that needs to be addressed is the totality of the claims issue and whether or not all the issues were addressed. And I'd like to specifically direct the court to the role that the statute plays in this instance. Again, the Lofton versus Lee case decided last year by the Supreme Court addresses the scope and the comprehensiveness of this statute and what it addresses. But I'd like to refer the court to the summary judgment response of the plaintiffs, wherein on page 119 of the record, they say the plaintiffs admit the plaintiff, Ciara Hiltz, was a person who suffered personal injury while participating in an equine activity and that her injuries resulted from dangers that are an inherent risk of an equine activity, such as the terms are defined by the Act. Lofton versus Lee dealt with exactly the same fact pattern where the criticism and the liability that was sought to be imposed had to do with the selection of the riding location. The predicate of the liability was where, choosing where to ride, and that gave rise to the liability and the notion that the Act didn't apply. And while I think that the plaintiffs or the appellants in this instance have put or laid that issue to rest, I believe it's important to note that it's this statute that they say applies, and it's our motion for a summary judgment that says this statute is the one that's controlling. The other thing I'd like to address at the outset is the summary judgment burden, and I think that is incredibly important for the court to sort out and determine who's right and who's wrong in this instance. Because in this instance, the view that's being expressed by the appellants is that the duty is upon us as the defendant not only to invoke the statutory liability immunity that we're entitled to, that affirmative defense of statutory immunity, but it's also incumbent upon us as the movement to disprove an exception or a plea in avoidance to that statute. And I submit that under Moorburger, that is absolutely not our burden. That burden is theirs to raise a fact issue on, not ours. That's not to say we didn't do precisely that, that we didn't address the second exception with respect to adequate or reasonable inquiry as to the ability of the participant. But it's important to note here that we met our summary judgment by demonstrating that this statute was applicable because this activity and the incident giving rise to the injury was an inherent risk associated with the equine activity. Now again, my thunder's stolen a little bit because the plaintiff admits that in their response to our motion for summary judgment on page 119 of the record. But I think it's very important to keep in mind. I think the next step that has to be considered as we go through it is to consider this kind of portraying of the factual evidence as being, there's inconsistencies as to what's going on. And I submit when the record is laid down side by side, page by page, it's not inconsistent. The one example I believe that the appellant addressed was this totality of time and this timeline, and it's not the same that if you look at Sierra's timeline and that of Mr. Rydell's, they don't hold water because Mr. Rydell says that she was in the pen being observed for 45 minutes, 30 to 45 minutes, and that's not what she says. She says something completely different. Page 68 in her deposition attached to our motion for summary judgment. Question, line 11. Question, how much time did you spend in the ring, the pen that we're talking in? About 30 minutes, 45 minutes. I was there for a while. Next page 69 of the record attached to our motion for summary judgment. Line 19. Okay, you spent 30 to 45 minutes in the ring. Did you feel comfortable on the horse? Yes. Did it act funny in any way? No. Miss Ciara's testimony as to the timeline, I submit, is not inconsistent with what Mr. Rydell testified at either. And again, I submit that Mrs. Ciara's deposition testimony, when compared with the testimony that Mr. Rydell provided in his affidavit as to what he did with her, is not inconsistent at all. Do they think that they could somehow create some discrepancy and invite you to try to find one? Yes, they do. But is it actually there? We submit that it is not. Let's take a step back and kind of look at what I think is the lick log in this case. And that is the testimony of Mr. Hiltz as to what he told Mr. Rydell as to whether Ciara could ride or should ride outside the pen. And I think context is everything. When Mr. Hiltz was deposed in January of 2011, here's his testimony on that point, and I'm reading from page 180 of the record. This is the summary judgment evidence that they brought in order to create a fact issue. What did he tell you that morning, referring to Mr. Rydell? That he had just two horses and that they were going to go riding. And I said, well, I don't know about your horses, right? I don't know about how old they are. I don't know how often you ride them. We just had the general conversation. I said, so it's going to make me feel better. You know, she loves horses, but it's going to make me feel better if she stays in the arena, right? That way we're in a controlled environment. So he said, well, I think that's probably a smart move, you know, so we'll just do that. That's his testimony when his deposition is taken. In no time does he testify that Mr. Hiltz beyond that said, she will not leave the ring, I will not allow her to exit the ring. And then in his affidavit filed, prepared and signed after the motion for summary judgment is signed, he says, page 162, I told Mr. Rydell specifically that I did not want Ciara to ride a horse outside the round pen area or pen on Mr. Rydell's property. Skipping one sentence, when I told Mr. Rydell not to allow Ciara to ride outside the open pen, I did so because I was concerned about her safety. Next paragraph, this is the reason that I gave the specific instructions to Mr. Rydell that Ciara was to ride only in the area for the anticipated activity. Again, I'm not attempting to split hairs, but I think it's very important to note that what's going on here is Mr. Hiltz is expressing his view. If everything he says is to be accepted as true, as we must for summary judgment purposes, everything he said is not, if you're going to allow her, then she can't ride. He expresses her view. At no time is there any evidence that Mr. Rydell ever agreed with her. And I submit it wouldn't matter. And here's why. If a parent entrusts their 13-year-old child to another adult on some type of outing, and the parent says, hey, Johnny's a great swimmer, don't worry about Johnny, you don't have to watch him. Custodial parent chooses not to pay attention to the children, ignores the children, puts them out in the middle of the lake. Are we really going to, as a matter of law, or legally say he has no duty or that parent has no duty to that child? That's an absurd result. The idea has to be, just as the statute reflects, that he, as an individual under the statute, if he wants immunity, he must behave in a reasonable fashion. He must make a reasonable inquiry. And I think right there we see another kind of how we want to kind of slip some paper into the middle of the story and rewrite it here. And that is, who are we supposed to listen to? The Hiltz position on appeal is, you can't listen to Ciara. She's a 13-year-old girl. You need to listen to Dad. Not her. She exaggerated her qualifications. When she said she had gone to summer camp and ridden horses for a month for the last three years, and that in California she took a riding lesson once a week for a number of years, we're not supposed to listen to her. He's not supposed to trust her. So where do we get that? Well, I submit we don't get it from anywhere. In fact, we need to look at what the statute actually says. And the exception to the statute that we're talking about here reads as follows. The person provided the equine animal and the person that did not make, excuse me, this is the exception, so I'm sorry, it reads a little funny. The person is liable for damages caused by a participant in an equine activity if the person provided the equine animal and the person did not make a reasonable and prudent effort to determine the ability of the participant to engage safely in the equine activity and determine the ability of the participant to safely manage the equine animal, taking into account the participant's representations as to ability. The legislature didn't attach the, hey, there's a special exception for 13-year-olds who tell you what their experience level is. I believe what the legislature intended was exactly what it wrote, and that's that you behave in a reasonable manner. And if the question is, if a 5-year-old tells you that he can drive a race car, no, Your Honor, I do not believe that's what the legislature said, meant, or otherwise would ever attempt to create the only way or and one of a few exceptions to statutory immunity of liability. But in this instance, where you have a 13-year-old who represents herself to have had extensive experience, coupled then, it is not standing by itself. It's not the representation that decides whether the exception applies or not. It's what you do, the evaluation you engage in, based upon the representation that's made. That's what the exception.
Judgment calls made by Mr. Riddell. One, that he served Sierra in the round pen 45 minutes, and it appeared to me that she had experience. And that after I assessed that Sierra had capable driving skills and ability, and received reassurance from Sierra, so there were two issues of here's what I concluded after I went ahead with making my own evaluation so that I could be looked at as doing a reasonable thing whenever I went against the father's instruction and let this girl ride outside.
Yes, Your Honor, that is precisely our argument, and that's because that's what the statute says. If there were an exception for the statute that says do not follow your own reasonable judgment, don't exercise your own reason when a minor is involved to evaluate, assess the skill level of the person, but instead follow the instructions given to you by the parent, if any, then that would be the exception that applied in this case. That exception does not exist.
You submit your question that you say is what the statute says about reasonable interpretation or reasonable evaluation, and you submit that to a jury. How's the jury going to look at this in terms of that being a fact question of who was correct? In other words, a factual question. Did the father say this to Mr. Riddell? And then Mr. Riddell ignored that and conduct his own interpretation, and his interpretation was reasonable.
Your Honor, with all due respect, if this statutory exception is the only question for the jury, I would question the relevance or the admissibility of Mr. Holtz's testimony that he told Mr. Riddell not to let him drive, because that's not in the statute. What it says is, based on what the participant tells you, in your evaluation of their skill level. Their skill level, his evaluation is the threshold analysis that determines whether or not there's an exception under the statute to the immunity provided by the liability. It's not a situation where the statute says reasonable based upon the totality of the circumstances. What it says is based upon what the participant tells you, is you and make a reasonable inquiry. And I submit if we take out what Mr. Hiltz and what Ciara said completely and assume they said nothing about her ability, that they were dead silent, that what he did was he engaged in an adequate evaluation and assessment of her ability to ride the horse such to allow her to go outside, just as the exception to the statute says, that's the only way you can get me in addition to these other exceptions. And in this instance, I believe that the reasonable exercise of care as a matter of law precludes the willful and wanton, the gross negligence claim. Very quickly, do I think that exists in all situations? Absolutely not. I can give you any number of examples where I believe you could engage in a reasonable inquiry, and then, just as the statute says, you could engage in an act of willful and wanton disregard for the safety of the participant. Ride up and slap the horse on the flank while you're riding beside it, even though you've engaged in a reasonable investigation. We appreciate the court's time this afternoon, and I apologize again for my tardiness.
Well, Mr. Rydell says, we'll do just that. I don't see how that's ambiguous. I don't see how that's anything but categorical. Categorical promise, agreement, that they're going to keep this ride confined to the pen. And furthermore, that's how he interprets it. When you consider our summary judgment evidence, he shows up at the hospital and apologizes for breaking his promise. If the statute says what the defendant says, subsection 2 says, then that's just all the more reason why you have to have a subsection 4 for willful and wanton disregard for safety. If what Mr. Rydell does is sufficient to satisfy his investigation duty under subsection 2, it certainly doesn't strike, I don't think, anybody as reasonable for him to go off and do an independent investigation to try to get around what her father said he should do and what Mr. Rydell agreed to do. We are right, our allegations are right in the sweet spot of what Lofton contemplated would survive summary judgment, and that is whether further inquiry would have prevented the accident. If Mr. Rydell wanted to change his mind and not do what he promised, then it called out for additional inquiry. If he'd taken that cell phone out of his pocket before they went to the pasture, rather than after they went to the pasture, called Mr. Hills and said, you know, I've been doing my own assessment of Sierra's riding ability, and I really think she rides better than you think, and I think we should be able to go on out to the pasture. Then that would have allowed Mr. Hills to say, no, I specifically instructed Sierra that she was not to go to the pasture on your horses, that she was to stay in the pen. I'll be there in 5 minutes, and I'll terminate this outing. Surely it would have made a difference. There are multiple fact issues here. Statute cannot be read, I don't think, reasonably, as the defendants have said. If it is read that way, then it can't survive the open court's guarantee. I have responded to any other questions. Thank you very much.
Your arguments have been very helpful, very interesting. Excuse to go back to business.